I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. We haven't talked about Benghazi for some time, and there's been a lot of water that has gone under the bridge on it. Austin, about a month ago, I guess at the beginning of the year, or at the very end of the year, you wrote an article on Benghazi, and you concentrated on some of the testimony that happened in Congress about it, because those transcripts have now come out. I'm proud to say that one of the people that you pointed out there is my representative, Jason Chaffetz, who lives just down the road here from me. But what was it that you found so interesting about the transcripts, and what light did it shed on Benghazi?
All right, that's a good question. It's a good way to approach it, because understand the transcripts that were published, and they were actually published, Dan, I'm going to say 11th, 12th of January, because I believe I wrote this column on the 13th or 14th. I wrote it the day after the House Armed Services Committee declassified classified testimony that they had taken regarding Benghazi in 2013. Not all of the testimony that I read. Understand, there were six PDFs, and I'll tell you what, I did the standard kind of thing that Al Nofi, Jim Dunnigan, and Austin Bay tend to do. We don't always do, but we're readers. We really are readers. I read or scanned four of those PDFs before of the, and there was almost total was over 400 pages before I wrote that column, and of course looked at the other two PDFs a little bit to see what they were. But the what I went through primarily was military testimony that included General Carter Ham, who was commander of AFRICOM, also a major general on the joint staff, I think his name's Robertson, who was Air Force, who was deputy director of operations for the joint staff. In other words, he's got a position that he's he has the authority on operations to speak for the joint chiefs. That's the operations officer. But this is all sworn testimony. One other caveat before I go into it, Dan. There are, you go look at it, you can download it, you will see lots of gray and black blocking out parts of the testimony. Much of it is still classified. It's redacted. Okay? There are even a couple of pages, I recall, the pages are completely redacted. So that's you, but you get a look at what occurred. And these weren't the only folks. There are some transcripts in there, too, from former Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta and Martin Dempsey, who is the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. I found the General Ham and the testimony from Roberson, that is, that's correct. General Roberson, the ops guy, to be the most informative. Now, after all that lead-in, let me answer your question directly. It made sense to me militarily, Dan. Now some of the things that I assumed would have happened, knowing the way the security intelligence alert systems, the way the chain of command works, there were things that I just assumed, and if our listeners want to go look at it, go look at the column in I think the date on it is September 18th, 2011. Understood, and I wrote it on the 15th or 16th, and of course these events in Benghazi took place on the evening of September 11th. 2011, and I really used what I know about tactical infantry operations, infantry tactics, but an operation, and I looked at it from that perspective, and you can see that thread in that column. But the thing that perplexed me is, excuse me, unless something absolutely horrendous happened, the information, given the kind of communications gear that would have been at the consulate annex and available to other groups within in the area, either U.S. or U.S. allied groups in Benghazi, or even some of the Libyans, you would have even been able to go around communication breakdown. In other words, and to provide the information up to senior commanders or operations cells that could not only alert senior administration decision makers, but we're in a position to send rapid reaction forces, provide assistance, potentially extraction, depending on what you had set up and available. And, all right, the answers were either stated clearly in the testimony or strongly implied within the in the testimony. One of the sadder parts of it, and some of this comes from General Hamm. There was also a former he's a State Department security advisor. I do not remember his name. I didn't refer to it in a column. It's certainly in the PDFs where they talk about our posture, our military posture, security posture, and the like. We weren't set for a response to a large-scale attack. Now, I didn't say terror attack. Terror attack could be one of a type, other type, on some of our facilities in the region, even those in a volatile place like Libya. And Libya being, look, the Egyptian military, we've talked about Egypt. They can handle Egypt. The Tunisian can handle Tunisia. Libya's in anarchy. And, I mean, Jim has, boy, made that evident with all the stuff he's been writing for the last 2.5 years about the situation in Libya. We didn't have on-call rapid response forces, either at sea, Marines potentially working off of a carrier, or didn't even have to have a carrier to get a Marine unit off of maybe an amphib, either in Sicily. I imagine a strike force, airborne platoon, special forces platoon, or whatever. They were not, and also the Aviano air base in Italy, which is a bit of a, it's not as close to Benghazi, but Aviano is, we have airborne infantry assets there. It's also a major air base. But then so is what Signorella, I think, in Sicily. Some of what General Robertson talks about too is the question of, could you have sent an F-16 to even just fly over and do a sonic boom, even if it had the wrong weapons to use in a close battle situation? And he provides, being a fighter background in fighters himself, fighter bombers, says it wouldn't have worked. There's also discussion about drones. Apparently, the drone up was unarmed. That's what I drew out of my read on that. In other words, now I see part of why the military didn't respond. It wasn't prepared. It's not all military's fault. They're certainly at fault there too, as well. State Department has a say in that, and then we can get into that component as well, because there was plenty of trail of evidence of requests by Ambassador Stevens and other security advisors within the area. I mean, Stevens is an executive, but the advisor is saying, we got to do something about Libya. And it was not addressed by the State Department. Now, as for feeding the information up, this was the most disturbing component of it. Apparently, and I say apparently, because you have to read part of what General Hamm has to say, and he's very careful in his responses to the committee, but General Hamm says, I knew about the attack within 15 minutes after it began. Well, how did you find it out? He was in Washington, and all of the theater commanders have offices in the Pentagon, as well as their offices wherever their major headquarters is, and some of them, like CENTCOM, have forward headquarters as well. AFRICOM is a little bit of a different beast. It's actually headquartered in Stuttgart with EUCOM, European Command, but then some of the politics. And AFRICOM is structured a little bit different than the other commands, but he's still a theater commander, General Hamm is, and he's got the office in the Pentagon. And he was there for apparently there's going to be a theater commander meeting. He got alerted by one of his aides, knew exactly what it was, told the aide, tell the chief, meaning General Dempsey, I'm on my way up. And look, I've been in those corridors. You know, he just, I can, and actually I can see it. This is the way the military works that I was in. So he bursts out because he knows it's important, and he's going to his boss. And he went upstairs, came in on General Dempsey, and says, you know, they're both generals, but one general's more of a general than the other one. He's the chairman of Joint Chiefs. He says, sir, we got a consulate under attack in Benghazi. Okay, and Dempsey says, I'm on my way in to talk to the SecDef. Let's go. And they're telling their aides, alert the SecDef. They came in on there, and they called it a terror attack. That's what he was calling a terror attack. And the out of the testimony on that, it's Panetta and Dempsey are on their way to the White House, and they said, we'll inform the president ourselves. So there, that, Dan, is... That's the way you're trained to do it. It's the way the system's supposed to work. Now, if Hamm knew within 15 minutes, that means his deputy theater commander, I'm assuming back in Stuttgart, I think that's what said, whoever his vice is. I think it's a vice admiral, as a matter of fact, three-star admiral. Now, three-star admiral has the same authority when to launch operations. But the thing is, though, is it's also his job to tell his boss. And there they were. This was it worked as it's supposed to work. Assets weren't in place, but there's also, all right, White House was told it was a terror attack. It had all the aspects of a terror attack. And you'll see some discussion in there about were there demonstrations and other things, but you'll have to read that, and people can interpret it their own way, but that was not the assessment on the ground, nor was the assessment being passed up. Likely, probable, what do we do assessment, Dan? And that is why I wrote what I wrote. Now, Mr. Chaffetz's point, he's getting a bit political about it, but I thought it was very interesting, and it was also part towards the end of Robertson's testimony, and it wasn't blocked out. So that was part of the reason it wasn't blocked out. And it did go to some questions about preparations. By the way, several members of the committee from both parties, I invite people to read it. You're going to see... heavens, they're not going to find a bigger critic of Congress critters than me. But these Congress critters, they knew what they were hearing, and that you can tell they were disturbed. And it was all, and they should have been disturbed. All right, I'll stop with that and let, because Jim's got a lot to say about Libya. I know.
So, what's the long term ramifications of Benghazi, Jim?
Well, there's more pressure on the Libyans to clean out the Islamic terrorist organizations. Now, anybody who is reading strategy page, and I know for a fact that there are many people in the State Department who read strategy page, unfortunately none of them are apparently way up in the food chain, would have known that there were that Benghazi was full of Islamic terrorists, al-Qaeda, what have you. Of course, it was also, I'm not going to get into the whole business of, you know, the government saying it was a demonstration against this Egyptian, you know, this Egyptian Christian who made a home movie, as it were, and put it up on YouTube about Islam. But that was foolish. I mean, you know, all I can say is, what were they thinking? Because it was you know, as Austin pointed out, it was obvious from the very beginning. And indeed, when you go over and look at the initial news reports coming out of Benghazi, like a day after, witnesses, people who were there, were basically saying there were guys with guns and RPGs, and there was a lot of noise from, you know, these weapons, which there were demonstrations against the, you know, the Egyptian movie, but there was no gunfire in any of those demonstrations. They were demonstrations, not an armed assault. So, you know, no one with a straight face can say that, you know, there was no, you know, Al-Qaeda is, I think, well, the New York Times did something silly recently about, you know, hey, it wasn't Al-Qaeda, it was somebody else, so there's no story here, move along. You know, this politicizing, you know, the real world really gets out of hand in situations like this. You know, it's one thing to have a lot of faith-based beliefs on how the world works. You know, hey, it keeps us going, gives us something to do, we're having coffee with friends. But if you're trying to keep people alive, it just doesn't cut it. And what you have in Libya, and as we, like, you know, we've been covering Libya since the revolution got really hot. And I went back and double-checked, and sure enough, there it was, you know, Al-Qaeda, this, and that's, we named the Ansar al-Sharia, the organization. In fact, more recently, after, you know, the attack in the end of 2012, we discussed the organization that was accused of actually carrying out the attack. There are actually three Ansar al-Sharia, you know, organizations in Libya and Tunisia, one in Tunisia, two in Libya. And they all come from the same group of Islamic radicals who the leaders basically were locked up, you know, for terrorism before Arab Spring. And then they were free, you know, along with all the other quote-unquote political prisoners. I mean, there are political prisoners and there are political prisoners. But, you know, the revolution decided it was prudent, you know, to let some of these bad guys, loose, along with people who were simply there for their beliefs, not their oppression for mass murder. And, of course, these guys went right back to where they had been before they were jailed. For life or 30 years, you know, for long terms. And they promptly founded these terrorist organizations. Now, Tunisia, which was the first Arab Spring country and the first one to overthrow its old, you know, dictatorship, they have since rearrested the guy who's basically the senior terrorist in, of these three Ansar al-Sharia, you know, terrorist groups. He was arrested in Libya at the request of the Tunisians, which is curious because the Libyans feel confident to arrest a Tunisian Islamic terrorist, but not one of their own. And of course, the reason is very simple. The Islamic terrorists in Libya are heavily armed. And as we explain time and again, you know, every time we do an update, which is several times a month on Libya, that the country has fallen apart. It never congealed after Gaddafi was overthrown because dictators do tend to impose order by force. And when you take away the force, all that pent up, you know, ideas and energy often, you know, gets out of control. We saw that in the Balkans in 1990s. And actually, to a lesser extent, in several other countries. We're seeing it in Ukraine right now. All that, this doesn't really get to the headline level on the West, what's going on in Ukraine. But it's again, basically tensions that were in the Ukraine for centuries, actually, especially during the Soviet period. And now they're talking about civil war. So a lot of these things, again, this is no surprise to readers of Strategy Page, a lot of these hotspots, these outbreaks, as it were, shouldn't be a surprise, because 90% of the time, more than 90% of the time, there's a buildup, and you simply have to look. As the saying goes, the devil is in the details. And in Libya, you have a problem which is not going to get any better. Again, by looking at the details, we know this, because Libya has come apart, and it's not coalescing again because everybody's fighting over the money. You know, it's like assume Gaddafi was a rich, you know, great grandfather, and he dies, and now all the, you know, the sons and grandsons and what have you are fighting over the will. And that's what's basically going on in Libya, because everybody knows there's oil wealth, and everybody wants more than their fair share, because nobody has the power to decide, you know, who gets what. So everybody wants everything. And the Islamic radical groups, like our local Al-Qaeda branch, and then there's Ansar Sharia, there's at least half a dozen major ones. They all have a different idea of how the country should be turned into an Islamic, you know, dictatorship, or, you know, Islamic Republic. It's basically a religious dictatorship. So you have a hopeless situation, because anybody, and if any of these groups should, you know, basically turn Libya into a religious, you know, dictatorship, they'll have all these other groups, Islamic radicals, saying, no, 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 you're not doing it right. So, I mean, you know, it's not unique with the Islamic radicals. The communists, you know, the Nazis, all these groups we look upon as classic, you know, the totalitarian movements, they all had their factions, which all had to be killed off before, you know, they could get the one group that would basically run it for us until they ran the economy into the ground and it falls apart. You always have this factionalism. And that's basically what's going on in Libya. Now, our ambassador there, he knew about that. Indeed, he was very popular with the majority of Libyans who have demonstrations after he got killed, you know, protesting the Islamic, you know, militias. And indeed, a lot of Libyans got killed by basically marching on the compounds of these Ansar al-Sharia and what have you, and getting shot, you know, for their trouble. But they basically, that was so scary to the Islamic radical groups, a lot of them got out of the city. Now they're still around, they just moved to the suburbs, you know, where they have better fields of fire, or a crowd comes after them. But they were basically frightened by the fact that they had killed a foreigner who was very popular with Libyans. Unfortunately, that did not prevent our ambassador from getting killed, because he did not have the security he needed. Now, this comes down to, you know, there was a crime committed, you know, the crime of, you know, incompetence, whatever you want to call it, somebody, whether it was political or just the basic incompetence, what have you, it was committed, and this basically has come out. This is why people are still making a big issue out of Benghazi. Four State Department officials were punished, quote unquote. They were demoted. Indeed, it's big news up in Canada right now that one of them, the woman who actually signed off on, no, you can't have any more security, she was demoted a level or so, and now she's and basically put on, you know, paid leave. What a terrible punishment. But now she's being prepared to be sent to Canada. And, of course, the Canadians are saying, they're sending her up here, so it'll be more difficult to bring her before Congress to give any more, you know, sworn testimony. So the Canadians have it figured out. And, of course, they're not too happy about, you know, that situation, because they've had their own problems in the past. You know, their diplomats being attacked and finding out that the government was more concerned with being politically correct than protecting the lives of their diplomats and Canadians overseas, which is basically what this comes down to. Because anybody who took a clear-headed look at what was going on in Libya, and again, this is no secret, this is a strategy page, you know, the internet is wonderful, you know, it's if you want to find out something, you can find it, and it's not, you don't have to be too, you know, astute, as it were, to separate the ravings of maniacs from this is what's actually going on, because you can, most, there are so many news sites out there, especially in the country you're talking about or neighboring countries, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what's really happening. So it's no secret what was going on in Libya with these militias and with the Islamic militias. And indeed, again, you look at the published accounts and some official statements, as Austin pointed out, our government knew within 15 minutes that, oh, my God, you know, our ambassador to Libya is under attack. Now, this attack went on for hours. And indeed, he eventually died of smoke inhalation, not of bullets. So there was plenty of opportunity to get in there, you know, to get on the horns to, you know, the Libyans saying, look, whatever you do, this is our ambassador. You don't want to be, you know, in the same, you know, penalty box as Iran, et cetera, et cetera. Nothing was done. People just, and most Americans, you know, don't approve of that. But our government basically felt it was more beneficial to them, I guess, to, you know, close their eyes and say, no, it's something else, than to basically say, hey, again, initially, oh, hey, let's save our ambassador. Well, they say after the fact that, oh, we screwed up. We're sorry, you know, we're really going to punish people. And again, this isn't just, you know, the current government, you know, the current government, but when Bush was president, when 9/11 went down, in the aftermath of that, who got fired? Who got hung, as it were, you know, one way or the other? Nobody. And again, there was plenty of evidence that, you know, we knew the facts were out there, but basically it was the old political correctness. You know, we can't, don't want to offend anybody. You know, that's a luxury you really can't afford, you know, with a lot of the nasty people out there. It's all very nice to have, you know, excessive memory, excessive manners, as I call them. But, you know, it can be fatal when you're dealing with people who don't believe in manners at all. And are more interested in shooting you than saying, oh, that's a nice new haircut you've got. Real world is a much rougher place than we would like it to be, and there's no getting away from that. And that's basically what you know, the American government response to the Benghazi massacre was all about. They didn't want to face the real world, and the real world is still out there.
So, Austin, I'd like you to comment a little bit on security, but also one of the facts that it's sort of pointed out here and there, but Ambassador Stevens wasn't a run-of-the-mill ambassador. He was. We lost a major asset with losing him there in Libya, correct?
Well, look, Dan, this way I'd put it. After reading the PDFs, but then the other stuff, I've been reading about Libya, and you know, you can, how many columns have I done about Libya since February or March of 2011? 8 or 9, okay. And how many I do? What, 52 a year? Okay. So how many is that? I'm just doing off the top of my head.
20%.
Oh, at least, you know, I mean, it's in the zone there. No, it's, you know, 18%. But that's close, right? Maybe I've done more than that because I've certainly done a couple of Arab Spring columns that were more oriented toward Tunisia, where also Libya was addressed. But it's there, but I've read all kinds of other things about it. Plus, we did that series of videos, are the little test videos we did on Libyan wars of the last century. Remember that's, you know, those videos are right there, and it's
on YouTube.
Yeah, Turco-Italian War, 1911-1912, which nobody knows about. You know, Rommel versus the Brits, everybody knows about that. Plus the first one, which admittedly kind of tossed it together, but you'll see the analysis and the military line of it pretty well stands up, even though events have show you that it was, when did we do that? Early September 2011? I think that's when at least it was basically put together. We didn't get it on the web till later that fall. But so been following it, following it closely. And this is what, one of the things that's emerged from it. Ambassador Stevens comes out looking pretty good, Dan. He's, as Jim said, Stevens was somebody who was aware of the granular problems in Libya. Well, good. That's what State Department Foreign Service officers are supposed to do. Be aware of the granular problems, even right down to knowing in who the local political leaders are in important areas of the country. I mean, local. And some of the Foreign Service officers know this stuff. Whether they call it political intelligence or diplomatic common sense, they really are the same thing in this case. In fact, diplomatic common sense, you know who the key people are, know what their issues are. Even if you don't like them personally as the diplomat, you, if you have the chance, you want to acknowledge them personally in this. Well, whether Stevens had met all these people or not, he understood what his job was. That's why Jim says he was kind of popular I would say that there's a substantial number of Libyans that would like to end the anarchy. Those are the indications. They are there. As Jim said, look what the number of people in Benghazi did after the attack. They just don't have the firepower to deal with the Islamist radicals. Who could provide them with the firepower? Who could help them? Well, if you're going to help them overthrow Gaddafi, this is what the follow-on issue of longer-term support for Libyan moderates, moderates within the Libyan sphere. They may not look like moderates to us, but they're people you can work with. Well, Stevens was aware of this, but he was also aware very much. I mean, and I don't have to document this. Heck, this is out there, as Jim says, on the web everywhere. He was asking for support, improvements. Yeah, there were political gives and takes. There's a kind of a, when I look through this, and yeah, I looked through it. I didn't study it, but it's in there about how he was negotiating about keeping a, I believe it was a special forces team under State Department control within Libya, so that they would have diplomatic immunity, but that was going to be lost and all this. And you see the politics, the trade-off of being in the bureaucracy, and the right thing is not done, guys. And he even signs off on not the right thing. It's the way it works. Folks, go read it. There's an extensive discussion about it, and it's also the big take on that is, hey, guess what? Our government, even on security issues, operates with that kind of bureaucracies all the time because you want to call them turf wars, you want to call them wars over budget and asset or whatever, and some of it's legit. But as Jim's saying, hey, wait a minute, Libya's in anarchy, and we have high-quality personnel there, not just Stevens, but his team, CIA people and the like. If you're going to put Americans out there in the line of fire, be prepared to defend them, and if you're not defending them immediately, extract them or support them. I'm stating that as not only what you want to do, but there's a moral commitment to it, Dan, a moral commitment to it. So, Stevens, to answer your question, yeah, I think the guy obviously had the skill set, but he also applied that skill set. So, was he a major asset? I don't know, but I tell you, I didn't know anything about him beforehand. Now I know a lot about the guy. The guy was doing his job in a very professional and committed fashion. That's my assessment after following this issue for as long as I have, which is, what, 2.5 years, I suppose? Yeah. And it's so is it a loss? Sure, it's a loss anytime somebody like that is a loss. Is it a double loss when you lose somebody with expertise who also cares about his job? Of course. There I'm speaking, you know, like common sense and addressing the obvious. But as Jim, look, one other comment on something Jim has said about the factionalization in Libya. You do have these various competitive Islamist groups. Some of them fight among one another. You know, they hate the United States no matter what. They hate the West. They do operate on hate and division. Substantial number of the Libyan people do feel, I'm addressing people who are antagonistic to one another, they think they've been cheated out of the wealth of Libya, oil wealth and the like. They're right. They have been. So they carry that resentment. But they also know if they can get some stability and they pump in oil, hey, maybe we're going to get some money out of it. Then you got to deal with this group that Dunnigan and I've been writing about for years, with admiration, I must say, the Berbers. The poor old Berbers down there in Fezzan, which is the lower part. Hey, look, but you move east and it was Berber territory. There are oil wells out there. Actually, some of the Berbers are the ones who said, let's deal with these nuts. Help us deal with these nuts. But they, even though they, when you give them weapons, they know what to do. Now, many of them are well-educated. Many of them have excellent contacts through Tunisia with France. And even though, you know, in the old Foreign Legion, Legionnaire days, it was the Berbers that the Bojess, you know, they're out there fighting the desert tribesmen. Most of them were, and at least in the French Foreign Legion romantic novels, they were fighting Berbers. But, hey, they get along now. And their deal is, what are you going to do about us? How are you going to help us? And if you don't, we're going to help ourselves. See that, Dan? See where I'm going with that? That adds to the volatility that Jim is addressing. And I just thought I'd bring that to the table because it's not dealing with radical Islamism. You're dealing with long-term ethnic ethnic identity, and you've also got, from what I've read, and it's, again, it's not just the Berbers, there are people in Tripoli, Benghazi, Misrata, Tobruk, that say, hey, we want to end this chaos. And they have, they're out there on the web as well. We want to end it, but we need help. We need help to get finish this point. On Chris Stevens was in contact with those people. He was their advocate, if you want to, and is basically what I've seen. He's their advocate.
Right.
Jim, wrap this all up for us. Where do we stand?
In the toilet. We still have not arrested anybody who is responsible for it. Our government is slowly, ever so slowly saying, gee, we made a mistake. That's progress. But, you know, it's like, you know, pulling a stubborn horse, you know, across the finish line. It's probably never going to happen. There's still this attitude throughout the United States government of refusing to acknowledge the depth of the hate and bigotry of the Islamic radicals, and the fact that there are a lot more of them out there than a lot of people in the government are willing to admit. I mean, if you go to Europe and just look at the opinion surveys of European Muslims, and you find that we're talking over 10% in many cases back Islamic terrorism. So, oh, yeah, it's fine. There's this feeling of resentment and entitlement, which, you know, they had back in the old country, and they bring to the new country. And basically, which is unusual with immigrant groups, well, especially in America, it's surviving from generation to generation. I mean, a large number of these Muslim immigrants do lose, you know, that hatred, which, of course, if you don't admit to it back in the old country, you can get yourself beat up or worse or killed. But, you know, when you're in a place like Europe, you still have a certain amount of that intimidation, but you still have a lot of people who willingly, you know, to an anonymous pollster, they say, yes, 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 you know, I can see their point, the terrorists and whatnot. And even Britain has that problem. The United States has it, but to a much lesser extent, which goes to show you it doesn't have to be that way. But until the West basically, you know, accepts the fact that they have a real problem on their hands, you're going to see more situations like, you know, Ambassador Stevens. It's not going to change until we basically change our outlook on, you know, the adversary.
Hey, Dan, I want to make,
yes.
I know we're wrap up. I want to make one point of not clarification. It's really an elaboration for our military audience. When I mentioned that General Hamm went straight to General Dempsey's office and said he was going to report to his boss. Literally in the chain of command, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is not the commander of the theater commanders. They report straight to the Secretary of Defense. However, the way it really works, it's not that General Dempsey or the chairman of the Joint Chiefs is directing operations or, you know, I'm commanding it, but he is the president and the SecDef's chief military advisor. So you always inform him, and effectively, or you're supposed to, effectively, he becomes all the theater commanders. No, you're not in the direct chain of command, but he is. And that's the reason that that vignette is very illustrative of how information flows. You'll see on the command charts this little dashed line over to the chairman of Joint Chiefs, but the information flows through him because he really is responsible for being the military advisor to the SecDef and president. In other words, a national national command authority, which is those two characters, the SecDef and president. I just point that out because I could see one of our very astute listeners say, hey, Austin, man, you know, the chairman, he really isn't the commander. You see what I'm saying? I just thought I'd bring
right.
it up. All right?
Okay. Well, we'll wrap it up there, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Thanks, Dan. Bye.
Indeed.